I'm Ainsley Earhart, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Monday, November 19th, 2018. I'm Grinnell Scott. The View at home and abroad, in the president's own words.
Chris really pressed the president on whether the prince lied to him.
I'm Chris Foster. A deep dive into the risky rescue of a boys' soccer team in Thailand.
They didn't know if they were hauling, you know, a heavily, heavily sedated child or a dead child.
And I'm Lisa Booth. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
On the November 18th broadcast of Fox News Sunday, President Donald Trump sat down for a wide-ranging interview with Fox's Chris Wallace, centering on many topics, foreign and domestic. From what does the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia look like in light of recent intelligence findings surrounding the death of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, to where the Russia investigation with special counsel Robert Mueller sits today. We touched on those topics with Fox News correspondent Leland Vittert, but I started with the effect of the midterm election and what does a new divided Congress to come mean for this president.
Obviously, the Democrats who are taking over the House are going to be gleeful about any opportunities they can to try and block and tackle the president's agenda. That said, the Democrats have their own internal issues, and we're watching that play out as there's this near fight to the death over whether Nancy Pelosi is going to be speaker or not. We already just this morning had now an 18th person come out and say that she is not going to vote for Nancy Pelosi for speaker, this being one of the incoming members of the freshman Democratic caucus. So there's going to be this question of how much can the White House exploit these divisions inside the Democratic Party, and how much can they try to either by cajoling and the president's pretty impressive skills when it comes to sort of the interpersonal cajoling, arm twisting, charm offensive and whipping, if he can bring over any Democratic votes on the House side from these districts that were Trumpian districts that were then won by Democrats. The flip side of it is that he now has an extra couple of seats in the Senate to play with, which changes the dynamics in the Senate, and then comes down to this big debate of whether or not you are going to have sort of legislating by the Democratic House or investigating by the Democratic House and the chess match between the two. We saw during the past couple of years the president sort of be brilliant in some ways in how he dealt with Congress, especially in dealing with the Senate and getting his two Supreme Court justices nominated. And in terms of getting things through the legislative process, perhaps you could say he's one for three, one being tax cuts, but border wall and Obamacare repeal and replace didn't happen.
Another of the issues that the president discussed during this exclusive Fox News Sunday interview was Saudi Arabia. And we've heard that the intelligence community is also giving its opinion on whether the death of Jamal Khashoggi, the journalist, is linked to the Saudi crown prince. And the president has said openly that he wants to maintain a friendship with Saudi Arabia. This intelligence finding really puts the president in a tough situation, because there will be critics who say, end this arms deal now. But the president says, we have a good ally and I want to keep it. Where does this go?
Well, in some ways, you're watching the intelligence community try and publicly pressure the president. You know, findings from the Central Intelligence Agency are not supposed to leak. So as a journalist, you have to say to yourself, well, why are these people inside the CIA, take for a minute at face value that what they're saying is true, that the CIA has concluded that the Saudi crown prince, MBS, did indeed order the hit on Khashoggi. The larger question, I think, comes in you're watching, and this played out in Chris Wallace's interview, I thought, really well. And Chris really pressed the president on whether the prince lied to him. And we saw this dynamic play out where Chris kept saying, did he lie to you when he said, I know nothing about all of this? And now it's pretty clear that the crown prince did know a lot about this. And you saw President Trump unwilling to sort of abandon the personal relationship he feels like he has with MBS, this being the Saudi crown prince, whether or not his public view of things and his public presentation of his feelings about another world leader is different than how he plays it privately is yet to be seen.
Our allies across the world are closely watching this relationship. How does that affect their view of the United States, and does that harm us in a certain way in the world view?
Well, remember, it was Winston Churchill who said that countries don't have permanent allies, only permanent interests. So around the world, you see countries realizing that this president cares more, at least he says he does, about America's self-interest on a almost tactical level than he does about, you know, the rule of law and sort of these greater ideas of a post-World War II society. Those intangibles seem less important to him than immediate self-interest. And vis-a-vis the Saudis, in some ways, you could say that this is America's return to our friends are our friends. Because remember, it was under President Obama that we abandoned Mubarak in Egypt. We abandoned Gaddafi in Libya, who wasn't really a friend, but he certainly kept the trains running on time in Libya and kept the jihadis out. We abandoned Saleh in Yemen, and we all know how pear-shaped Yemen has become. And while Assad wasn't a friend in Syria, he certainly had begun peace talks with the Israelis, and he had sort of made some other overtures to cracking down on extremists and allowing U.S. operations inside of Syria and holding Iran, if not at bay, certainly at arm's length. And Obama abandoned him. The Russians have come in and picked up on a lot of those relationships, specifically in Egypt and obviously in Syria. So maybe this is blocking and tackling by the president of trying to keep the Russians and others out of Saudi Arabia and letting the world know that if you're a friend of America, which the Saudis certainly have been in many ways over the years, not a perfect relationship, but this also could be viewed in that way, that we're willing to look the other way on bad behavior if you protect American interests abroad.
Let's touch on one more topic while I have you here, and let's come back here at home for this overarching storyline about the Mueller investigation. The president seems to believe that it's ending soon, but there are many in Congress who say, let's continue to let this play out for as long as it needs to play out. What's sort of the lay of the land there?
Well, both things can be true, right? In the sense that you can have people in Congress saying it needs to play out as long as it does, and it can also be that Mueller is coming to the end of his investigation and that these questions that the president says he has provided written answers for, and in that interview with Chris Wallace, he talked about coming up with those answers to the written questions. Is it related to collusion before the election? That could be the end of the investigation. The one thing that I firmly believe as a reporter, and I'm sure other reporters may be better sourced, but nothing has leaked outside of the Mueller team. There have been leaks about the investigation. As far as I can tell, none of them have come from inside the Mueller team. That thing is buttoned up tighter than a Coast Guard lifeboat going through a hurricane. So it seems as though if the president knows what's happening inside the Mueller investigation, he's probably one of the only ones. So whether they've gotten a tip off or whether the lawyers for people very close to the president have gotten indications that indictments are coming or indictments aren't coming, that could be where they're getting their information. But as far as anybody having really clear insights, if they do, those who know aren't talking.
As they say, we live in interesting times, and there is so much.
Yes.
There is so much to watch for. Leland Vitter, thank you so much for taking some time with us.
Good chatting.
This is Lisa Booth with your Fox News commentary coming up.
It's 5 months ago that 12 boys and their 25-year-old assistant soccer coach in Thailand went exploring in some caves after practice. It rained, the water rose, and they got stuck, missing for 9 days until a pair of British divers found everyone on a ledge in a partially flooded cavern.
We are coming. It's okay.
It's okay.
Many people are coming.
Many, many people.
We are the first. Many people come.
What happened next involves some tough decisions and a risky rescue mission with the kids' families and people around the world watching and hoping for the best.
So the family was posted in this tent right outside the mouth of the cave.
Matt Gutman covered it, and he's been back since to catch up with everyone for his new book, The Boys in the Cave, Deep Inside the Impossible Rescue in Thailand.
And so the journalists, there were literally 1,000 accredited journalists there. It was crazy. Yeah. Would walk right by them. We weren't really allowed to talk, but I snuck in to talk to some of them before the rescue. And that's when it really hit home, because I'd been to one of the schools and I'd had taken pictures of the drawings and notebooks and T-shirts that one of the kids, Bew, had put together. And I showed it to his mom, and she started crying because it made her feel like, I get that she's a person and that these are families, that these are real lives at stake here.
Yeah, it
really hit home.
It wasn't a TV show for them. What was the mindset of the kids when they were found? I mean, had some of them just given up? They hadn't eaten. What were they doing down there to not go insane?
Well, that, you know, it's interesting. So the kids had been kept on a regimen by their coach, right? So they wake up, they'd sleep at night, all together huddled in this carved out space. They would wake up. They would drink as much water as their bellies could tolerate. Then they would start digging a hole that they'd started, and they made it, you know, 10, 12 feet in into the limestone, just scratching away with their fingers and their hands and sometimes with a good rock if they could find it. And then they'd rest and sleep, and sometimes they'd go out into the water to try to test it. And they were constantly trying to test the water, but they weren't good swimmers, and they couldn't get anywhere because they were locked in this tunnel because it was all submerged and pitch black. They only used one flashlight at a time, so by the time they actually were discovered again, they still had battery power. But, you know, were they losing their minds? I don't know. When they finally were discovered, they told rescuers that they'd heard children playing and dogs barking,
wow,
roosters crowing. And that's what happens in a cave. If you're there long enough, you begin hallucinating because there is a complete absence of all the ambient noise that we're used to. I hear a lawnmower outside. My chair is squeaking. I hear the air conditioner, the buzz of electricity, the hum of electricity in my room. And they had none of that. It is complete audio visual deprivation. And so your mind starts to go and do wild things. And all of them claim that they heard the chickens and the kids, even though they were under 1,500 feet of rock, pure rock. And you know, when the rescuers got there, they're like, whoa. But it's pretty common for kids to, for anybody to have hallucinations like that if you've been in a cave for that long. So, yeah, I mean, and the Thai government wanted them to stay for 4 months, in which case they either would have drowned to death by the rising waters, been asphyxiated because there was only 15% oxygen left in that room and it was going down, starved to death because they couldn't get food back there, or lost their minds completely in 4 months of complete deprivation.
Well, the government just figured we have to just let them ride this out until the monsoon season's over because they'll never be able to swim out. That, I guess that was the thinking, right? And then what convinced them, and how was the plan put together to get the kids out?
So, exactly. The government wanted a zero-risk option. They didn't want a hair on the head of those kids to be harmed. But the U.S. Special Forces, there was a U.S. Air Force Special Tactics team that had been there almost from the start. And they had really started to organize everybody and figured out who the best divers were. They were Brits. What they needed to do to finish the job, needed an anesthesiologist to be able to sedate the kids to bring them out, and what it would take. And they basically planned everything, and they finally went to the Thai government. They're like, hey, listen, we have another major monsoon coming. This rain is going to dump so much water into that cave that these kids might drown. Even so, it's going to create a current, and we can't swim against it, and we can't take them out. We are not able to reprovision them with food because there are only a few divers in the world who can make it all the way back there. There's 15% oxygen in the room. These kids are going to die. We need to go in there and go in there now if you want to save even one of these kids. Otherwise, they will all die. We can't promise you we'll save all of them. Maybe we can only save one of them.
But they will die if we don't try.
All of them are going to die. And so they did this thing, and it was really touch and go for a bunch of the time, as I learned reporting the book. Two of the kids nearly died as they were being extracted. One of them stopped breathing for nearly half an hour, and they resuscitated him and kept having to resuscitate him. Another guy, one of the divers got lost with his kid. Another kid had hypothermia. I mean, it was insane what was going on in there. And the fact that all of them were brought out alive is truly miraculous.
I didn't realize. I thought when they said we sedated the kids or were going to sedate the kids that they gave them something to calm them so they wouldn't.
No,
so
man.
They were out.
No, this was ketamine, elephantine doses of ketamine. Okay. Literally, you could have amputated an arm. You could have done open heart surgery on these kids and they wouldn't have felt a thing. The thing is that ketamine is short acting. After 25 minutes, it wears off. And so these divers who are really, really, really good at cave diving, but are not medics, are not doctors, are not paramedics, have to resedate the kids in the middle of this dark tunnel, pitch black, doing something they've never done before, which is give a human an injection. And so they're in the dark, in the tunnel, pinning the kids against the rock. It's one diver, one boy, and they've got to find the pouch in their wetsuit that has the syringe with the needle, and they're putting it together with their mouths because they're holding one hand on the boy to keep him from floating away. And then they resedate them as these kids are coming awake, and these divers are thinking, what the heck did I just get myself into?
And
so it's touch and go the whole time, and then they've got to do it 3 to 4 times for each boy in these dark tunnels just to keep them from waking up and freaking out.
Right. This wasn't like a cave on Gilligan's Island or something, or it wasn't like just a straight shot in or a straight shot down. It was a series of tunnels. Some of them you couldn't really – you had to squeeze to get through, right?
You're so right. I should have said this earlier, but, you know, imagine if anybody's driving – basically the space between your steering wheel and the gas pedal. Some of the spaces were that small, and they would have to actually shove the kids in first or go in first without the kids and then pull them behind them. The spaces were tiny. People were getting stuck. People couldn't find some of these spaces sometimes. It was very, very harrowing. You also have, you know, these very jagged rocks, and the kids were getting their heads bashed around because the divers couldn't see anything. The water had about 6 inches visibility. So at times, they couldn't even see if the kids were breathing in their masks. And sometimes they'd push them out to the American medics who were waiting for them at one of the areas where they finally were able to have a little bit of space. But that was a mile in. Or after a mile of swim, and they'd push the kids out to the U.S. pararescuers, and they'd say, are they alive? Is he alive?
They didn't know.
They didn't know if they were hauling, you know, a heavily, heavily sedated child or a dead child.
And one volunteer diver, the only death during this whole thing was, I don't know, a few days before. A diver was, what, laying oxygen tanks or a guide rope or something?
Yep, he was an ex-Thai Navy SEAL. He was a triathlete, perfect shape. He'd been going very, very long. It's unclear exactly what happened to him. Thai government hasn't come out with a final report or any report. But he somehow died laying these oxygen tanks. And there are a bunch of different theories, which people can read in the book. I lay them out. But he should not be dead right now. That guy should be alive. But again, when you have 10,000 people all trying to help, there's a lot of duplication of effort and a lot of mistakes made, and I believe that this was one of them. So it was extremely unfortunate that he died.
And as far as you know, how are all the kids and that coach doing now, physically, psychologically? Everybody bounced back?
Yeah, more or less. You're going to love this one, Chris. But, you know, so I went back to Thailand for my third reporting trip about 6 weeks after the rescue was over, and I was trying to – I met the kids and the parents, and the kids were all out at one of the boys' birthday parties, and they're very, very close, all the soccer players now. They were close before, but now it's, you know, that's all they do is hang out together. And they were riding their bikes around Maesai, this little town in northern Thailand with no street lights, potted holes, in the middle of the night, 9, 10 o'clock at night. And I'm sitting with the parents, and I'm like, you know, if this were me and I have a 10-year-old soccer-playing girl and she had just been locked in a cave, I would never let her out of my sight. Like, she'd be leashed to me. And they said, in order to let these kids heal, we have to let them go. In order to keep them close, we have to free them. And so we want them to be adventurers. We want them to be the boys that they were before. And so we've got to let them take a little bit of risk in order to keep them sane. And I love that. You know, I truly believe kids have to be kids. You've got to let them make a few mistakes, not tremendous mistakes, but you got to let them be kids. And I love that advice. I don't know if I can, you know, affect it myself in my personal life with my kid, but I try. I think about it consciously every day, and I just love that piece of advice from the parents and the kids themselves. It was just great seeing them riding around and doing their thing.
It's a great story, one of the great rescue missions of our time or all time. Matt Gutman covered it. His new book is called The Boys in the Cave, Deep Inside the Impossible Rescue in Thailand. Matt, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Chris.
Looking for opinion done right? Then go to FoxNation.com and pre-order right now. Fox Nation is the new streaming subscription service that will have exclusive daily shows, incredible documentaries, and must-see on-demand programming. That's the perfect complement for every Fox fan. Plus, go to FoxNation.com, pre-order now, and get one-of-a-kind exclusive merchandise. Available now, but for a limited time only. Don't miss your chance to become a founding member. Go to FoxNation.com and pre-order right now.
Here's a look at the week ahead.
Tuesday. Whitney Houston said, "I believe the children are our future." We start the week off by expanding on that idea, as Tuesday is Universal Children's Day. Created by the United Nations in 1954, its goal to promote the welfare of children across the globe.
Wednesday.
What's expected to be a very busy travel day. AAA estimates close to 55 million Americans will travel 50 miles or more for Turkey Day.
Thursday.
Thursday is Thanksgiving. History says the Plymouth colonists and the Wampanoag Indians shared a feast marking the first Thanksgiving in America back in 1621. President Abraham Lincoln made it officially a national holiday in 1863.
Friday.
Shoppers, Black Friday's right around the corner. Eager bargain hunters will try and save a buck on some early holiday deals, but check for savings at your favorite stores online before you shop until you drop. And that's a look at your week ahead. I'm Jack Callahan.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Lisa Booth.
What's on your mind?
An op-ed published this week in the Wall Street Journal has ignited rumors of a potential 2020 presidential run for Hillary Clinton. The piece discusses the different iterations of Hillary Clinton the public has seen over the past 30-plus years. But none of those versions became president, and no matter how many times Clinton tries to reinvent herself, she cannot change who she is at the core. Inauthentic, unlikable, and out of touch. According to the op-ed by Mark Penn and Andrew Stein, headlined "Hillary Will Run Again," Hillary Clinton 1.0 was a universal health care promoting progressive firebrand in 1994 when she was first lady. Hillary Clinton version 2.0 was a moderate when she successfully ran for the Senate and again when she lost in the Democratic presidential primaries to then-Senator Barack Obama in 2008. In 2016, Clinton 3.0 was a progressive who moved further to the left because of her challenger for the Democratic presidential nomination, Senator Bernie Sanders. And Hillary Clinton version 4.0 will run for president in 2020 by returning to her roots as a progressive, Penn and Stein predicted. But the fact that there have been so many different versions of Clinton is precisely the problem. Clinton is inauthentic. Former Obama advisor and Democratic strategist David Axelrod nailed this point about Clinton in the 2016 election when he said authenticity is a big factor and a leading indicator for candidates, and they have to be comfortable in their own skin. There is no one wishing that Donald Trump would speak his mind. Hillary Clinton has always been allergic to revealing herself, and when she does talk, it comes out through a political filter. Clinton's authenticity has also taken a major hit over the years because she has changed policy positions depending on where the political winds are blowing. This gives the perception that she is not rooted in any core beliefs. One issue that probably hurt Clinton most in the Rust Belt states was trade. As Secretary of State in 2012, she backed the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, even calling it the gold standard. However, she changed her position in 2016 while under scrutiny from Bernie Sanders on the left and candidate Trump on the right. Clinton also has a likability problem. In an interview with the Washington Post, Democratic pollster Peter Hart put it this way. "I bring it down to one thing and one thing only, and that is likability." Clinton is also out of touch. Her surprise pit stop to an Ohio Chipotle in 2015 while on the campaign trail demonstrated this. Despite it being a great opportunity for pictures with customers, she wore dark sunglasses in the restaurant. She couldn't be bothered to speak with anyone. Clinton's infamous basket of deplorables comment also underscores this point. In response to her comment calling his supporters racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, Trump responded that Clinton showed her true contempt for everyday Americans. Other gaffes also speak to Clinton's disconnect with voters. In response to a question from ABC's Diane Sawyer in 2014 about her $200,000 speaking fees, Clinton said that she and President Bill Clinton came out of the White House not only dead broke, but in debt. President Clinton received a $15 million advance for his memoir after leaving the White House, and then Senator and former First Lady Hillary Clinton received an $8 million deal for her memoir. In what will be likely a crowded 2020 presidential primary field, Hillary Clinton would not stand out. Her time has come and gone. She is a relic of the past. No amount of pollsters, speechwriters, or consultants can change who she is. And that is why she will never be president. I am Lisa Booth.
You have been listening to the Fox News Rundown. Stay up to date by subscribing to Fox News Radio's hourly newscast at foxnewspodcasts.com. And for up-to-the-minute news, visit foxnews.com.